next guest tonight is Andre LaRue. His father was a native Alaskan, born literally off the coast of Ketchikan in a fishing vessel. His father was sent to a native school system in California. Am I getting this right, Andre, or were you the one who was sent to the... Are you around? I'm doing all right, okay. Was sent to a native school system in California. His grandmother... Okay, so it says Andre's father was sent to a native school system in California. His grandmother changed his father's name to get him out of the native school system and into the public system. Andre moved back to California. He was the first in his family of five siblings to return to Alaska. And this was back in last April, 2011. Andre has been a gardener and a maintenance person at the Glory Hole. He hunts, he fishes, he collects stamps and coins, and he's been involved with the Native American movement for the last 20 years. So please welcome Andre LaRue.
There's a lot more history that goes with that. We were originally Hansons, and the reason that my grandmother had to change our family name is back during the 30s and 40s, the school systems were still segregated, and the native school system only went up until middle school. There was no high school beyond middle school. So in order to get him into the system, she borrowed the name of the dentist, who was my grandfather's hunting partner, in Wrangell. And that's how we ended up with the last name of LaRue. Well, while my father was in school down in California, he went to work in a gas station. And back in the early days, gas stations were owned by the oil companies. So he, in essence, had begun to work for an oil company. And he worked his way up through the chain, and eventually out of pumping gas and pumping up tires and cleaning windows and all the other goods that go with taking care of vehicles, into working into the oil refinery. And he was so good at his job that when opportunity came for the United States to begin developing the Middle East oils, he was sent over to the Middle East to Iran. And as an infant, I moved from California to Iran. And because both my mother and father worked, I didn't learn English. I learned the Armenian language. So when I came back here to the United States as a child, I had to transition from speaking old Persian to English. Well, that went good for a while. And they began to build a new oil refinery here in the United States down in a little place called Pascagoula, Mississippi. So one day we're out on San Francisco Bay fishing, and before we get out of the harbor, us kids had counted 500 boats on San Francisco Bay. This is early 1960s. Dad looks over at us kids and goes, "Boys, it's time to move." So the next thing we know, we're sitting 30 miles south of Mobile, Alabama, in a little town with a population of 40. The little town got to be famous from Forrest Gump. It's a little town called Bayou La Batre, Alabama. And as the Pascagoula refinery was being built, Bayou La Batre was quite a drive for my dad. So we decided we'd move closer. And we moved from Alabama over into the Mississippi area, and we moved into the Pascagoula area. Well, as time went on, we ended up going back over to the Middle East several times. And during that time, my father, of course, he had gained quite a bit of money, decided that, well, we'll just build a new home. We're not going to rent from anybody else anymore, have neighbors or that kind of thing. So we moved out into the countryside. Back then, where we moved to was a little town called Goshen, Mississippi. Again, population 40. Real good for a kid growing up, you know, into his teenage years, wanting to date. You had to drive a long ways to go snip a skirt if you were a guy. Well, I graduated school in Mississippi, and while I was in college, I got married. And moved over into Louisiana to be closer to where my wife's parents were. My parents were still living overseas. They were in the Middle East. So I had no family here stateside. So we lived there for a period of time, and when my parents finally retired, they built a home down in Florida. And once again, I had to transition from one state to the next, only this time I had to carry three kids with me, along with all our pets. And it was kind of difficult to move everything in a pickup truck. But got it done. Lived down in Florida for 20 years, a little over 20 years. And while we were in Florida, my father had gotten back involved with doing Native American powwows. And I got involved with it because my father had gotten involved with it. And it was during that time that I really began to learn what my Native culture really was. You know, as a teenager, I was told about it when the Alaska Natives Claims Act was settled. My grandmother and my father had been enrolled in Sea Alaska. And, you know, the 70s was a real transition time from back of the prejudice towards being a Native American to where it became cool to be Native again, which was great. So I began doing the powwows, and I learned some of the cultural stories and histories, listening to my father tell them, as his father had told them to him, and some of the studies that he had done. Well, there's a story that my father told for a number of years that I've never seen written anywhere. In all the literature and all the different research that I myself have done, I've never seen it anywhere, and I kind of like to share it with you because it's comes from the time of the Native American culture prior to the coming of the Europeans, before the trade era. And it starts off with a tale of a vessel being destroyed on our coastline and washed up. And when this vessel had washed up, it was kind of different. It had two things that were different about it. Number one, the bottom was made of copper, and this is how the Tlingit people came to know what copper was. It was from a shipwreck. The Chinese had begun to line the bottoms of their vessels with copper to stop the shipworms from eating into the wood. Well, this particular vessel, when it had washed up, it also brought an outsider, a human. And this human was a very, very large man. He was so large, in fact, that many of the natives considered him to be a giant. Well, he wasn't a fisherman, and he wasn't really a hunter. He didn't really know what to hunt, but he knew that humans were edible, and he hunted us. Well, over a period of time, this gentleman had taken several of our hunters out and about, and the elders became very, very concerned over the people that were going out to get our meat, weren't wanting to go out and get our meat because they themselves became meat. So they held a council, and they decided the best thing that they could do was to capture and kill this man so that we could go back and do the things that we would normally do. Well, they derived a plan where they would dig a pit and capture this man in a pit because they knew which areas that he hunted along. Well, in order to have the pit, they had to have somebody to draw this man to the pit. So they held a competition, and they had to have a twofold competition. First of all, you had to be able to outrun this guy. And second of all, you had to be able to jump far enough that you could clear the pit so you yourself wouldn't fall into this pit. Well, they found the people that they wanted to do this deed, and they went out along the trail. And they dug a very large pit, and they lined this pit with pitch. And then they hid more pitch up in the bushes. Well, they, of course, you know, being Tlingit people, we always have a potlatch before we do anything very, very special. So we had our little potlatch ceremony and offered things to the clan members who were going to be the actual runners in case that they themselves would be killed along this way. And after the potlatch, we sent our runners out. And they went to the cave where this particular man dwelled, and they goaded him and taunted him. And eventually, he, of course, came out and he chased them. And they led him around for a period of time, and then finally they led him along the trail where they knew this pit was. And they jump over the pit. Well, of course, pit being big, huge pit, and this man being so big and heavy, he couldn't jump that far, and he ended up in the pit. And no sooner had he fallen into the pit than the people jumped out of the bushes and they began striking their fire implements. And they set him on fire and poured more pitch on him. And as he lay there in this particular pit, burning, his last words were, "I shall curse you from now until eternity. I shall drink your blood." And as his ashes flew into the air, they became the mosquito. This is a true legend. This is how the Mosquito Clan was.